Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs to order. Today is a rainy day, and it is March 3rd, and it's 8 o'clock in the morning. And I'd like to open a subcommittee until we get one more member down here for a full quorum. Before we start, we're going to be hearing, and I forget what the bill number is next week that we're hearing. The only thing about the bill that we're going to discuss, we're not going to discuss extending the health fund board or repeal the sunset on the health fund board. We're just going to talk about the data collection on that at this point in time, if that means anything to some of you out there. All right. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 452. Mr. Shook.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 452 establishes the Health Information Technology Oversight Council within the Department of Human Services, supporting the accelerated adoption of health information technology and the development of a statewide system for electronic health information exchange.
And Ree Sailors is coming up from the Governor's Office, and she will introduce the panel since no one signed up for this bill.
Oh. Push this down. I can drive. Okay. Great.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Morissette. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning, and we are here to talk about Senate Bill 452. I'd like to introduce briefly the members of the panel. First of all, for the record, my name is Ree Sailors. I work for the governor as a health policy advisor. This is Dr. Dick Gibson, who is the CIO of Legacy Health Systems. And next to him is Ken Carlson, Dr. Ken Carlson, who's a pediatrician here in Salem. And then next to him is Dave Wyden, who is with Safeway Pharmacy. And he will be, each of us will be talking about a different aspect of 452. I will begin by talking a little bit about the stimulus, federal stimulus package, and how 452 and health information technology is featured in that, and to kind of create a context for why 452 is before you as well. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act basically provides a set of incentives for ambulatory care physicians and hospitals to encourage them to adopt electronic health records, and also the exchange of health information across entities. Meaningful use must be achieved by 2012 in order to take advantage of the incentives that are in the stimulus package, and there will be numerous federal, state, and local organizations created, but it's very important for us to understand that our state planning and others throughout the industry, that planning for the implementation and usage of this health information technology really needs to begin now if it hasn't happened already. You may have heard that in toto, the stimulus package had roughly $19 billion dedicated to health information technology. 17 of that $19 billion is devoted to increased payment rates under Medicare and Medicaid for providers, both hospitals and ambulatory care physicians, who have quote-unquote meaningful use of electronic health information technology, and I'll talk to you a little bit about that. In addition to increased rates to their normal rates, increases to their normal rates, there's also provisions for some reimbursement of their expenses for acquiring, installing, and use of maintenance of health information technology. That reimbursement for the expense of putting that in place, particularly for physicians, amounts to about, depending on where they draw that from, either Medicare or Medicaid, somewhere in the neighborhood of anywhere between 65 and 85% of their costs. in terms of meaningful use, is used throughout the stimulus legislation, and it gets to be defined by the Secretary of HHS, but it at least means the following, because it's clearly articulated in the stimulus bill, that it must include e-prescribing. It has to have health information exchange that promotes quality improvement, such as care coordination, and the providers must be able to submit certain quality measures to the Secretary of HHS, and that secretary, she, now that we know a little bit, she will define what those quality measures would be. We're pretty certain that they will follow along in the path of what we've seen happen already in the Medicare arena. The technology that is adopted and available for reimbursement and enhanced rates must be certified electronic health record technology and HIT technology. Those certification standards are developed at the federal level. The state does not have the opportunity to create their own standards, or we probably could, but we'd create a fair amount of havoc if we tried to do that. So those standards are available now. For those of you who have heard about this stuff, probably two-thirds of all the standards have already been approved, and the remaining third of standards are in the waiting line for blessing. There are, so in addition to the $17 billion that's available to, for direct provision of increased rates and reimbursements to physicians and hospitals, there are also state grant opportunities, and these are competitive grant opportunities available to the states. They have, they represent a high leveraging opportunity for the states, and they begin with a 90-10 match, go to a 7-1 match and a 3-1 match, and I apologize, I couldn't do my math to give you the exact numbers on 7-1 and 3-1.
Now, when you say 90, meaning we only have to put one part in and the and then we get
right.
90.
We give them 10 cents, they give us 90 cents. So that's a very high leverage capability. And if you read this whole thing, which I don't encourage you, but if you're having sleepless nights, by all means, the whole thrust of this legislation is to really put a push on to get implementation over the next few years. And then if implementation and usage isn't fully accomplished by somewhere in the neighborhood of 2014 or 15, then there are a series of penalties that begin to happen to those providers who have not fully adopted or are not having meaningful use of electronic health technology. And those penalties come in the form of reduced reimbursement rates under Medicare and Medicaid as well.
Just a question, when you were talking about this is for physicians and hospitals only. So what entities would be excluded? Maybe that might be the most interesting way to put this.
We don't know that any entities will ultimately be excluded, and some of this, we're waiting to hear more details come out of HHS in the wake of Congress passing this and the President signing it. So the ultimate goal of this is to have a National Health Information Network, for Oregon to have a plan on how it will plug into that National Health Information Network, and that all healthcare providers would have electronic health records and the capacity to exchange information across providers and across organizations.
Madam. So so a pharmacy would be able to access this, be a part of this stimulus money or not?
Correct. For e-prescribing purposes, pharmacies okay. would be, and I should back up and tell you that the certified softwares, so to speak, the certification standards include already packages within that software package is included kind of a module that is there for e-prescribing and some of the other requirements that are called out in the Act, too. So if you purchase certified, and the term is CCHIT, but if you purchase certified technology, then it has the inborn capacity to be able to perform the functions that they want providers to be able to perform.
So ambulatory surgical centers would be a part of this, but maybe insurers would not?
We're talking about electronic health records, and this would be clinical records in nature. They would augment, I think, what I would call the administrative and payment records that we have today. And if you think about healthcare in general, a lot of the electronic health records we initially developed in this country were around scheduling and billing. And what this push represents is the opportunity to bring electronic health records that are clinical in nature, that help increase quality, decrease repetition or duplication of testing and so forth in the healthcare system, and allow treating providers to be able to see the information they need about that patient at the point of service.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I'm interested in the tie into broadband opportunities for grants. Now, I know there is broadband that extended to Burns. In between Burns and Bend, for instance, they can transmit records and diagnostic tools and so on. I also understand LeGrand is tied into perhaps a different system. Are we going to have a stimulus? Are we going to have stimulus money to lay the cable, the broadband? How are we going to achieve that, which we have to do before we have a system?
Yes. First of all, I'd like to back up and say that at the governor's office, we are working to try and coordinate the various opportunities that we have under the stimulus grant, and that includes opportunities that are available under broadband. There is a crossover between broadband and the Stimulus Act and use of broadband for healthcare related purposes, and so we will be trying to coordinate the applications of the state for those opportunities. In addition to that, Dr. Gibson is actually the chair of the Oregon Health Network, which was, you might remember, we received an FCC grant about 12 to 18 months ago for about $21 million to do the last mile and mid-mile connections in the state so that we could connect hospitals and clinics in rural areas together. So part of that is in motion, and then in addition to that, there are additional dollars available under the stimulus package for more broadband work. One of the things you should understand, too, is that in order to have health information exchange, we need to have broadband.
Yeah.
So the two do go hand in glove. There are a lot of other uses for broadband as well. But in order to ultimately get to the sea change we're after in healthcare, which is to kind of bring it kicking and screaming into the 21st century with technology, is to really make sure that we have broadband capability and that we can connect providers no matter whether they're individual ambulatory surgical centers or physicians or hospitals or clinics or whatever. That is the idea, so that we can get the right information about the patient to the provider at the time of service.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I've been interested in a long time in electronic records network. I guess some of my concerns are, I've always envisioned a closed system where the medical community has the information. I'm not overly thrilled with the federal government having the information. And so I guess my question is, what sort, do we have any idea at this point what sort of strings are going to be attached? I mean, would we have, do you think, the ability to create an Oregon-specific network, or are we going to have to be driven to the federal system?
I think we have the flexibility to develop an Oregon specific. I think every state has the opportunity to develop a plan. However, ultimately, it's not that the information will have a federal repository where everybody's health information is going to be stuck in a big silo somewhere at the federal government level. What the federal government is saying is that everybody in all states have to have a system that allows for the exchange of health health information. And as a country, we need those state-to-state communications to be able to follow the patient. So if I end up in Idaho with a skiing accident, which is highly unlikely, but mainly because I've never set foot on skis.
I think you probably would have an accident. I think it's pretty likely.
Yeah, right. Then my medical records would become available to the emergency room in Idaho that might be seeing me. So it's not that the federal government is going to take your information. What they're saying is we have to have the capacity to move the information so that it follows the patient and is available to the clinicians.
Right, Madam Chair, I appreciate that, but being the paranoid skeptic that I am, I look down the road, I think that's where the federal government would like to go, and I would caution strongly against moving in that direction. But quite honestly, having government too involved in this, I think defeats the purpose. This is if it's a medical system, and I also think we got a lot of PPOs right now that have developed systems that work really good in their communities. It's a matter of what sort of system we put in place to allow an information exchange without necessarily compromising what currently exists. So the Department of Ed's got a good model for that. So
okay. Yes, Senator Bates.
A comment, a question. As the only practicing physician on the panel here, I'm going to throw a little cold water on this, not from the point of view that we shouldn't be doing it, but that first off, in the last 10 years, as we've tried to go to medical records, electronic medical records, as a primary adult, a primary care physician taking care of adults, the multiplicity of different electronic medical records across the state has made it more difficult to obtain records of patients, dramatically more difficult.
Yeah.
I've got patients that have insurers that require them to get their labs done at a certain facility, and the lab may be done in Kansas, and I can't get that information. The VA system is not operable for people outside the system. Province Medical Group's electronic medical record system is a disaster to read from a physician's point of view, and you can't even access it. You have to get a fax over. My last time I asked for information on a patient from their electronic medical system, it was 200.
Is that one of the panel's phones? If you could turn that off.
So sorry.
That's all right.
Reeve, that's your way of getting out of this. It's not going to work. It was 200 pages long of gobbledygook.
Yeah.
And it goes on and on and on and on. What I found is that for specialists dealing with patients just in their own practice, some of these electronic medical record systems work very well. They're very specific to that practice. They're very specific to those patients. But we find patients drop between the cracks in these things, and a lot of things that patients need to have done for them don't occur because they're seeing two or three specialists. There's no coordination of care, and these systems can't talk to each other. And we can't break into them. We cannot break into them. We've got all kinds of portals they've given us, all kinds of ways of getting in, and we can't get in. Okay. What I want to know, and this is the question I'm leading to, does this bill or any other legislature we're going to look at address that problem and give you the authority to start making these systems really and truly interoperable? Because they aren't now, and they're actually getting worse. They're blocking. They're because of HIPAA and because of patient confidentiality, the systems are getting harder and harder for me to access as a physician. And I understand that. We want to protect the patient's confidentiality and their privacy rights, but it's got to the point you just can't get anything. And we're back to paper records. More paper records than I've ever seen before.
Ramona Sanderson, Senator Bates, you've put your finger on exactly what's being addressed in at the federal level, and also, and I will get to in a minute exactly how this particular bill and this oversight council play into that. But Dr. Gibson will also talk to you about the previous activities of the health information infrastructure Agriculture Advisory Committee that we've had, and the recommendations we came to try and help the physicians kind of ferret through those hundreds of systems and figure out which one's best for them. And then the federal government, in terms of the health information exchange, is basically saying we have to get these systems to talk to one another, and that's what this sea change is all about. So it is a recognition that we've built these things up in silos, and it's time now to cross over the silos so that we can do it in a patient-centric fashion rather than an individual entity at a time.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Well, could we maybe hear what the panel has to say, and that might address your questions?
Possibly.
Yes. Okay. Keep that thought, please, Senator Bates.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. I was talking about the grants that are available to states. We estimate there is probably an excess of $500 million dollars available to states on a competitive grant basis. These come in basically three varieties. One type of grant is a planning grant, which can help the state create a plan for how it will do health information exchange. It also can help in the promotion and adoption of electronic health records. There are implementation grants which require that the state have a plan, and then once we do have a plan, we can receive federal dollars to help implement that plan and help providers implement those plans. And then, interestingly enough, there is also a loan grant opportunity where the state can set up a loan fund with an 80-20 federal match to provide upfront capital for particularly physicians in small practices, rural areas, and those with high numbers of, for instance, Medicaid patients. We, under that scenario, we are allowed to also receive private dollars and use that as the federal match. I would also say that the Health Oversight Council that is in this bill, 452, and the dollars that support that can be leveraged as part of the 90-10 match under the state grants available to the state under the Stimulus Act. And so because we are also allowed to use in-kind contributions as our match. So our support of the Oversight Council and creating it as an entity in the state that is charged with seeking and receiving those kinds of federal grants and everything really can bring us initially a 90-10 match, and we can use those as in-kind. I wanted to show you a little diagram of sort of the potential, thank you, Ken, of what we have going for us. At the top, you see HIAC, which is an existing mechanism, and what we would propose to do is to replace the HIAC with the Oversight Council that's in 452. That in 452, we charge the Oversight Council to create a state plan, which talks about things like governance, privacy and security, enhancing participation in exchange. These are all things that are really getting us in position to be an eligible entity under the Stimulus Act for purposes of getting grants. We also have taken some of the recommendations of the HIAC, which were also adopted by the Health Fund Board, which talk about developing a purchasing collaborative. This is the idea of using the state's purchasing expertise and power in order to get discounted arrangements and to also narrow that field of hundreds down to a manageable set of vendors and get discounting pricing arrangements. So if you look at this slide, we have the opportunity to contract for discount pricing, pass that discounted pricing to physicians who in turn can receive loans. If we set up a loan program to initially help capitalize that, we can talk to the feds and say we can reduce your cost by our discounted arrangements. And once the physician is in meaningful use, they get enhanced reimbursements, which allow them to help repay the loan. And they also get reimbursement for the actual cost that of the materials and services that the loan has purchased, up to 85%. So you can create potentially sort of a revolving loan fund to help our providers in this state have the ability to get the equipment into their offices. We're particularly looking at smaller practices, rural practices, and practices with a lot of Medicaid in them too. So it really creates a nice synergy effect of having the stimulus bill, the recommendations that came from the health fund board, and the opportunities that to put the two together and make something happen here in Oregon. The final things that I would show you on this is the designated entity this is language that's used in the stimulus bill. It can be the state or a not-for-profit. At this point in time, until we have a plan, we're recommending the Oversight Council be within the state. It has to have broad stakeholder representation, which you'll see reflected in the language of the bill. And you can see the actual purposes that this designated entity would serve. Again, what we've been trying to do, and there are a series of amendments that we're proposing to the bill which would further refine the language so that we are in alignment with the stimulus package language so that we can optimize our drawdown of the competitive grants. I can go through those. I think they're in front of you on your desk, but they're relatively simple amendments that are basically authorizing the Oversight Council to seek and receive grants and donations. We strike the number of 23, as you all will have to confirm these people, and we thought 23 was a little bit large, so that's been changed to 11. Basically, there's a travel-only compensation for these individuals, and then we're clarifying sort of what are the purposes of this. We have one amendment that comes from our health equities group, which we've been trying to address in a variety of bills, where we will use this technology also to help address underserved populations as well. And also we have it meeting quarterly instead of monthly if it need be. And that initially it's appointed by the governor, particularly because a lot of the stimulus grants, the governor literally has to sign for these things as we apply for them. So I think with that, I'd like to stop and ask Dr. Gibson if he would kind of take over and give you some information about how we got here and why it's important.
Good morning. I'm Dick Gibson, Senior Vice President, Chief Information Officer of Legacy Health System in Portland. I have a PhD in Medical Informatics from University of Utah. I've been working in the field for 18 years, and Ree and I chaired the Health Information Advisory Council, HIAC, which was started last spring. And this bill is the outcome of a process that involved 23 representatives of providers, of hospitals, health systems, insurers, consumers, purchasers, and people from the state. And we concluded in November, and what you see before you is the outcome of that group. So I just wanted to briefly review the major tenets of the output of the HIAC and how they influence our discussion this morning. I think that the biggest aspect of the HIAC is realizing that of all the physicians in the country that are office-based, half are in practices of only one or two physicians, and only about 8 or 9% of those physicians have access to an electronic medical record. With all due respect to Dr. Bates' concerns about progress with electronic medical records, I think that the momentum is there and that current systems are doing much better in terms of providing an adequate summary for physicians referring to the hospital, referring to other physicians. And that is part of the national standards by the Certification Commission on Healthcare Information Technology, CCHIT. CIT, which is the federally agreed upon para-government group that certifies the interoperability of electronic records. And they are building in their 2008, 2009, 2010, and 2011 standards the ability to interoperate with the summary. So instead of giving, as I realize has been true in the past, 8 or 10 or 12 pages of lots of poorly focused data, the new standards talk about a continuity of care document, the CCD, which has 20 elements, including the medication list, the problem list, the allergy list, procedures, support people at home, that sort of thing. So I think we're going to see a lot more concise interoperability document. And that will serve from going from physician office, from office to hospital, from discharge from the hospital to back to the office. And that the vendors are being, well, ultimately will certify their products, will be certified in their products that they can give that document and receive that document. So I think what we're looking at is that Kaiser and other staff model HMOs got it a long time ago that there's great value in having all the doctors and hospitals on the same record. But if you're not in a staff model HMO, the challenge has been how do you have independent hospitals and doctors do that? And now with the coming national standards, we see our way to doing that. And we believe that HIAC will provide the incentive for primary care physicians and other physicians to get on board. As Ree pointed out, the way to help them purchase that is by a purchasing coalition that not only picks three or four vendors in which to subsidize within Oregon or achieve a better price, but also to look at getting service providers, the contractors and consultants that will help physicians adopt the records, so help the physicians buy the nationally sold products and install them in their practice. So it's not only a coalition for buying the software, but also a coalition to line up a group of contractors that can help physicians install it, because there will be that's a significant effort to get a practice onto an electronic medical record. A second part of the HIAC's output was to encourage the use of interoperability standards. So the national, the CCHIT at the national level is certifying vendors' products for interoperability, and the only products that would be help to install with this bill would be those that have achieved CCHIT certification. Oregon also has received a separate grant from Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services of $5.5 million a year ago to build an Oregon Health Record Bank. And that's already under development. And the idea there, that would start with Medicaid beneficiaries and would ask private providers that see those patients to send a summary document to that health record bank for them. So that if they were discharged from the hospital ideally would send a discharge summary to the Oregon Health Record Bank for Medicaid patients, and that the provider in his or her office in follow-up would be able to access that record and find out what happened in the hospital. And then when that physician had finished in that office visit, he or she would send up their record of that office visit to the Oregon Health Record Bank so that the next person that saw the patient, if it wasn't the same physician, would have access to the record. And then the other part of the Oregon Health Record Bank that they're going after is to give the patient some way to see who has seen their record and perhaps even to manage who sees their record in the future. Now, I understand Senator Bates' concern that it's been challenging to get records electronically. I think it's mostly because the output has been not summarized. But I do think that we need to allow the patient to have some control over who sees their record. And this is challenging, but people all over the country are working on this with the Health Information Security and Privacy Coalition. That's also had an Oregon base. So the first part was a purchasing coalition to help doctors buy records and get service providers to help put them in. A second part was to encourage use of national standards, starting with the Oregon Health Record Bank. And we're hoping that over time that could be enlarged to be a mechanism of interchange between all providers, not just and all patients, not just those on Medicaid. Another big part of the HIAC recommendations and bills concern the privacy protections for health information. The committee spent more hours on this single area than any other aspect of the HIAC bill. I think the three biggest outputs were that there was concern and debate about allowing the patient access to their record. One, so they could see their record, and two, so that they could see who has seen their record in the past. The second part is allowing patients to opt in or opt out of having their health record exchanged with the Oregon Health Record Bank or with any exchange within the state. And number three, providing meaningful remedies if security or privacy were violated. So that's going to require more legislation, but it's important that we recognize that as we have more electronic records on more patients, that the patients are going to need to be involved in whether they're part of this or not. Well, health systems, hospitals, and office providers are challenged to pay for and adopt electronic health records. We encourage passage of Senate Bill 452 to help Oregon organize and prepare for health information exchange and for the technology that will promote better health care. Many of the large health systems are already deeply invested in electronic medical records. Having more physicians and providers use interoperable health records will enhance that previous investment. As Ree's already pointed out, this Health Information Technology Oversight Council will also help Oregon prepare for the stimulus from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act so that we're ready to apply for those funds and ready to help providers adopt electronic records. In summary, I believe that this council and this technology can allow providers to get better information at the point of care and to demonstrate their superior care to people that grade their care. I think that it will allow patients and families to be better involved in their care. It will allow patients to control who sees the record, and it will allow researchers and purchasers to pay for only those health interventions that improve the health of the patient in the community. So I thank you for consideration of these recommendations, and I'd like to entertain your questions.
No?
Ree, would it be better to have questions now or go ahead and have Dr. Carlson and the rest of the panel?
Yeah, I think Dr. Carlson will give you a kind of a bird's-eye view of what it's like to have electronic health records.
Okay.
I'd also, while he pulls his screen up, the other thing I would say is that the federal stimulus bill did also have a lot to say about the privacy and security thing that Dr. Gibson mentioned, too. So we
okay. Well, let's finish with the panel, and then we'll...
Okay, thank you.
Cross-examine.
So my name is Dr. Kenneth Carlson. I don't know if I'm going to be the bird's eye view. I think I'm going to be the person on the ground kind of view here and things. So real quick, full-time pediatrician in practice, coming up on 10th year, and did participate in the HIAC and the recommendations that went through that. The office I work at is a community pediatric office right here in Salem, long history, over 30 years. We have 11 pediatricians, 2 physician assistants, and 2 nurse practitioners. So we are, I'd say, a medium to large independent group. So we are not part of any networks. We are individually owned, and thus we're the ones having to create these systems. So we're newborn to 18. We are between 45 and 50% Medicaid. So that has not been a barrier to us adopting these new technologies. And we have no plans to limit our participation at this point in that. So our total database is 42,000. We did have to convert all those people that we had seen on paper into our record. We do about 3,500 encounters a month. We've probably about 34,000 that have been seen in the last 3 years. So we're asking a lot of our systems that we have now. So here's our office here in Salem. We built it about 2 years ago. We were already electronic at the time, and so many of the aspects of the electronic record went into the building design, and it did, you know, affect how we set up our place. So just some quick pictures, a quick tour here. So everyone's looking at screen when they're in the office. So these nurses taking calls, they're accessing, they have immediate, access to that patient record for every phone call. In the paper system, you generally do not have that unless you're going to have a delayed callback. So every phone call always has access to the record. This is it's Casual Friday, that's why the t-shirt, but as one of our medical assistants, so he's about to go get the patient. So they're roaming around the office, wireless, small handhelds. He's pulling up the chart. He's quickly looking to see if they called and talked to the nurse already that day. What did they discuss? Can quickly see any special considerations, maybe a pop-up. Call the patient Johnny, not Bill, because he goes by his middle name, all those kind of things that get very quickly, and can put that information in the chart there. So there's our chart room. So not a typical medical chart room. Quite a bit smaller than most chart rooms as well. Maybe just as messy, I don't know. But and there. So and where this really affected our staffing is Bell Medical Records Department. So there's one more station behind where I took the picture, a total of four workstations. That's our entire medical record department. You don't see piles of charts there. There's a scanner there kind of to the right. That's how a lot of data, the paper data, gets into the record, as well as coming in through the phone lines and our fax server. So real quick, Wayback Machine, we started in 2000. We were out of space. So that's from Raiders of the Lost Ark. I don't know if anyone recognizes it there. We just had no more space for charts. That drove it. So either we were going to have to remodel, make more space, or start off-site storage. And was just tired of not having ready access to the information. So those were really the big drivers back
Where's
then.
The chart?
Back in those dark days, there weren't a lot of electronic records around. So we were kind of pioneers in the community, which means we were kind of on our own there. The initial challenges we faced were the same as that are now. I don't know that they've changed too much. So was cost was, of course, the biggest. You know, which one do you purchase? Again, we hope that this organization and the state can help them make those decisions. Certainly your hardware infrastructure, who's going to support this, who's going to drive the implementation, who's going to keep it going. You need IT leadership. You need physician and provider and staff leadership. And it does, it slows down the office. You are changing your workflows when you switch over to this. We would estimate that overall, over the years, for the the medical record side and the practice managed side, that we're getting close to $500,000 here, total investment over the years. Probably about $140,000 to get that started. It was just our experience. If those dollars are different now, they may be. Just with the network costs, and everything changing, it all depends on what product you implement, the size of your practice, and everything else is going to affect those. So a lot of these costs will be directly offset. We went through this with our vendor recently as they were putting together some marketing materials. They wanted to know more about our experience and just figuring out, your medical record staff, the cost of storage, creating a medical chart. We estimated it was about $10 in staff time and cost and materials to create each record, regardless of how long they're going to be with your patient. So that's a scary number, but there are some things to keep in mind that offset that. So why bother? A lot of people are aware of the benefits already. But for us, it was we wanted to have the record. We wanted to stop chasing it around. We wanted to stop paying people to spend their time going through desks to find the information, to find the charts. We now have information available for every phone call, every office encounter, and we're not limited by space as well, by where you are. So the same thing happens on the weekends, evenings. We have secure access into our system. As long as I've got an internet connection, I'm in there and I can see that. So I have information. Better information is better care. So much of what we do in medicine is collecting data, and we're time limited in that. So there may be times where we'll give up looking for the information and just reorder the test. So there's certainly duplication comes into the system, and which then creates waste and cost, of course, and just isn't patient-centric. Certainly a lot of benefits on the prescribing things. You've heard about e-prescribing. I'd say as far as how interfaces are at this point, that's probably the most mature interface is between physician offices and pharmacies for the e-prescribing network. SureScripts is the national vendor that primarily manages that at this time. So we see time savers. It certainly can automate the repetitive tasks, automate the brain dead part of our jobs and spend more of our time talking to patients and medical decision making. The biggest thing that this gives us that we don't have on a paper system is using the data. So now you're actually going to use that data and report on your data. Any type of quality program is completely dependent upon having data available. Trying to do that in a paper system, you're paying research assistants, and only the universities get to do this. So now the individual office with a mature EHR can track their immunization rates, can track how many asthma patients are coming in, and are they the right things being happening. Now, of course, the tool doesn't just do that by itself. That takes energy and people and knowledge there too. So I'm hopeful that this oversight committee will kind of support and offer not just get the HRs in the office, but really teach people how to use them to the best that they can be. So where things are for interconnectedness, and I would say that this is definitely the biggest challenge for the next 5 years for EHRs, is that interface. And we do need the national standards to help us with this. Like I said, right now, what we have in our office currently is the e-prescribing, and we've probably been doing that going on probably 3-4 years. So we were early on that, and that's working very well for us. It's both ways, pharmacies also sending things back. We do have one interface with one of the regional labs that took a long time to set up, and they were both national vendors, our EHR and the lab. It took a while, but we got it there. We now get our results directly, not as a piece of paper, but as discrete data into our record. We do have login guest secure access with Salem Hospital and OHSU to view when our patients do go to that. Now, we have to actively go and do that. It doesn't come to us, and there really isn't a true information exchange. I'm in a web browser when I'm looking at that, but it's a start. Our patients communicate with us through the internet and a web portal. We hope to change this to a new system soon that has even more functionality, but currently they can log in, they can send us messages, they can view some limited data from their chart. So that's the interface with the patient that's so important that we feel is where we need to go. So, but pretty much everything else is through a fax server. So Senator Bates mentioned stacks and stacks of paper, and yes, most output from EHRs is not formatted in a very clean, summarized way. When it comes to us through a fax server, we're not seeing the piles of paper, but those discrete image files are getting put in our chart, but it's still just an image file. It's really not the meaningful data. So exchange between EHRs is at its infancy. We need a lot of help here. The national standards plus support here in Oregon are really needed to do that. So a lot of things stand in the way. These are things that hopefully this oversight committee can really help. Many of these questions have already been brought up. I'd say of that list, the technology barriers is probably the least of our problems here. We need the good standards, the broadband infrastructure, and then just the regulatory and what do you exchange? That's probably the biggest question here, because we, as a provider, I don't really need it all. I'm getting it all. I'm getting that fire hose now. So I am optimistic about, the clinical continuity record, the CCR, and then now the CCD that was recently put in place that is part of the certification standard. So I guess with this, are EHRs ready enough for this? I would say yes. They're far from perfect, but what's happened in recent years is I think we are seeing more of these 2.0, what I would call EHR 2.0 features of reporting tools and data analysis. I think for a long time, the EHR, EMR just duplicated what people were already doing on the paper system. They wasn't really giving them any new information. It gave them access. It gave them different ways to sort and organize, but it really wasn't giving them ways to use and share that information. But these things are now finally coming. There's been a lot of consolidation in the vendors. It's very hard for offices to pick, so one of the big barriers is which EHR do I buy? I'm hopeful that this oversight committee can help with that by narrowing that list to 4 or 5 ones that then can also be supported by this organization and get them not only the potential monetary support, but the technical support in how to use it. And certainly certification standards have also really matured, evolved, are widely accepted. They really set kind of a minimum standard, so you still can have just a mediocre that meets all the standards versus a great one that meets or exceeds these standards. But these standards are evolving every year. 2007, the focus was on security. 2008, the focus is on interoperability. So the next version that we anticipate from our vendor will bring these things in. There's a big patient quality movement in this country. You need data to drive these programs. It's great to have the energy, it's great to have the people, but without the data and the EHRs, it's just not going to happen. And I'd say the final reason it's time for EHR is what Reese was talking about. The clock is ticking. We've got a stimulus bill now that not only is going to reward the early adopters who are in place by 2012, but it's going to start penalizing people that don't get involved, and we need Oregon to be a part of that. And so that's my hope for the IT oversight is to create and guide that infrastructure in the state so that the health information here supports the doctors so that we can get the EHRs in. They have the technical support, which is probably even more valuable than dollars, in making it meaningful and making it work. And also to interpret, it's great to have these federal standards. We want them to work for Oregon so they can interpret these and help to apply, apply to us. So I'll leave off there.
Who created your PowerPoint?
I did.
Youth. Mr. Wyden?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dave Wyden. I've been a pharmacist in Oregon since 1970. On the HIAC Commission, and working with part of this. Also a member of the Statewide Pharmacy Coalition, who also is supporting of this bill. And tangentially a member of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. So that I'm seeing the values of this from the patient safety standpoint from that commission as well as from the electronic. Talking from the pharmacy side, about 99% of the pharmacies in the country are ready to accept electronic prescribing. The nature of the pharmacy business, it needs to be done for productivity, but it also brings safety. And I'm not sure that Senator Bates will agree or disagree. A lot of physicians' writing is difficult to interpret.
I couldn't read one of my own last week.
So it gives the pharmacist the right product, the right dosage. And what the electronic health records do is allow, there is a lot of patients who shop pharmacies, shop physicians. This would bring that together under electronic health record, so you could get drug interaction checking regardless of the prescriber. Some of that may be intentional on patient's part, but some not. They go to an ophthalmologist, don't think to tell their private practice physician they were there. They go to two pharmacies because one's closer to home and their way home from work. So now you've got two prescribers, two pharmacies involved, and a lot of potential for drug interaction. As Ken mentioned, SureScripts is the main electronic prescriber aggregator. All the pharmacies get these from an aggregator, which is, there's three of them, and SureScripts is the main one. Ken writes the prescription, transmits it, it comes to us. We can send back to them for refill requests, and in the event a pharmacy is not electronically connected, and I say we're 99% there, the SureScripts has the capability to send that information to the pharmacy in a fax format. So from the prescriber standpoint, it doesn't matter. It gets to the pharmacy electronically from, you know, Ken doesn't know, it could be carrier pigeon once he pushes the button, but it gets to the pharmacy. So that is the reason we are supporting, you know, aside from my personal involvement in HIAC, supporting this to as a starting point, as a oversight committee to get the electronic medical records. Critical, I think, to what we're talking about with the stimulus package, but also to the health of our Oregon citizens.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Senator Morissette, well, and Senator Bates, and then Senator Morissette.
You're a Safeway?
I work for Safeway.
Yeah, okay. Well, do all of the pharmacies and the chains in Oregon have that capacity?
Yes. We've been driven by national requirements as well, but it's relatively simple within our system. The hard part is now getting back out, so I can't see any records from any other provider. I mean, if I want to see Fred Meyer record, I've got to call them. So, thank you.
And I would echo my experiences that, yeah, just in the last, and this has really just happened in the last year, that every major chain, at least in our service area here, is on board. So there are a few independent pharmacies that are not. There are a lot of independent pharmacies that are, which is exciting to see. So I think they've made that so that even the small ones can participate. So.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of quick questions and statement first. We all know we're going there. Don't get me wrong. We're all going there. It's a matter of when, and big question is how, and what do we got when we get there. Dr. Carlson, have you found that this system has actually allowed you to cut down on errors in the office? Has it helped out with, I mean, one of the big pushes here is physician errors, and they're mainly errors of omission. We forget to do things. Has the system allowed you to have less problems with omissions?
Yes, I think, yeah, errors can come in, you know, in different forms. I think our system, and again, as these systems become more mature, it's going to help us in many different ways. One, just having information available, you're not going to repeat something that's already been done, conflict with something that's already been done. Allergy alerts, yes, allergies are well documented, but you're moving fast, you still prescribe something they happen to be allergic to, it yells at me now. you know. And if it's something that's a related medicine and I want to override it, I got to put my reasons in that chart as to why I'm going to do that. We're just now, I think prescribing is probably where the biggest safety is. When I'm prescribing a medicine, it's pulling out of a standardized database. Medispan is doing that. So I can't misspell a medicine. I can't prescribe something that doesn't exist. The pharmacy may not stock it, but I can't, you know, it doesn't exist somewhere. And in a form that I do it. If I say something 300 milligrams per mil, but it doesn't really come that way, it comes as 250, I can't do that. It keeps me on standard centered things. We're just now getting a dose calculator, so some of those kind of checkings are in its infancy. Probably in the next year, it'll start yelling at me if I prescribe outside of the range. So I guess those would just be some quick examples off the top of my head there.
Okay. Follow-up questions?
Yes, please.
The other issue I hear a lot about is physician and provider efficiency. I mean, when you first put the system in place, obviously your efficiency goes down. You're trying to train people and understand what's going on in the system. Mm-hmm. After the system has matured in your office, what I hear commonly is, I can't see as many patients, it takes me longer to see them, but I like the system, I'm not going to change. Mm-hmm. I like the system, but it really does push down efficiency for a lot of physicians. I still hear that from fellow physicians. Is that a problem in your office, do you think?
I think, you know, we've talked about that, and, you know, trying to think back. Now, you know, it's for us, our office has changed in a lot of ways. We've grown a bunch, and also with the new building. Yeah, I think that it really ties in with your workflow and how that patient moves through your office. An electronic system makes you rethink a lot of that stuff. So if a system, I think if an office tries to stay with their same systems but just put in computer instead of paper, they will have some efficiency problems down the road. If they re-examine some of the systems on how a patient moves through their office, I'd say that we are at least as efficient, maybe more. Again, it's hard for us to, you know, I think most of our, you know, efficiency has come from our building design and just, you know, making sure that, you know, doctors are close to the patient rooms, they're close to their printer, and they're close to their the waiting room and things. So I think that we are at or a little bit above where we would be on a paper system today.
Thank you. I hear a lot of questions about this both ways, and I'm not sure who's telling the truth on it. Mm-hmm. One last question.
Yes.
Read this question for you, if you could. So I had to save my questions. She wouldn't let me ask them. You know. she rules with an iron hand. Many of us think that the next jump in electronic medical records is not what we're talking about here. It's a patient having a card, and on that card will be the information they really need. And there are a few systems out there I've heard about, and sort of a Star Wars sort of thing, that is available now, smart cards, chip cards. Was that part of your discussion at all?
Well, I'll take an initial stab at this, and I think probably Dick may have something to add to it. There are a number of vendors who are coming out with what I would call personal health records, which, as a layperson in this, studying it over the last 12 to 18 months, I kind of look at electronic health records being an initial building block, which is the clinical record inside the physician's office, for example, with the capacity to move information out of that building, so to speak, as the primary building block, and then the second step being sort of health information exchange and the ability of clinical information to be going. The other piece that I see is the personal health record, which is very consumer oriented, probably formatted for a consumer versus a clinician, and I think a lot of the vendors that we've heard, Microsoft Vault, Google, Intel, and a variety of others have come up with personal health records. I think what's important to remember about those is that you have to get information from the clinician in order to populate these things. So in my kind of simplistic way of looking at the world, I see the push needing to happen at the clinician adoption of electronic health records so that information can be put into personal health records for consumers to have, whether they're a smart card, whether they're web-based, whether they're one of these thumb drives, whatever that technology may be. But you still have to have that fundamental place where inside a provider's office they have to have an electronic health record system that has the capacity to offload information and move it to
whatever. For instance, Dick's testimony talked about a health record bank. If you want your information sent to the health record bank, it has to still come from the clinician. And so I see that as sort of the fundamental building block. Dick, you want
to
talk?
No, you handled it very well, Reed. Thank you.
And follow up?
Yeah. I'm going to go back to what Senator Cruz is speaking to, because I share some concerns about these huge data banks being set up with people's information in them. And to get that information to one place, you've got to break down a lot of barriers between various offices and various institutions, and you're putting all one repository. And one of the pluses I've heard for the patient being responsible for this is that each location would have an electronic medical record. They would have access to each one of those locations. They could put their own card or their own chip or their own disc, and they'd be responsible for carrying that. And it wouldn't be one repository. And for someone to break in and get information on a single patient, they have to break into multiple places to get that. Maybe the new electronic technology we got will prevent that from ever happening. Could. You can always break into my office tomorrow and go to my records room, knock the door down, and get the record out. I mean, it could happen. And more likely is an employee getting in there and taking a look at those. And that's happened, too. So no system is completely secure, and I realize that.
And
I'm just wondering if the next step is one that's going to be a jump forward in which the patients will not only be the center of care, but they'll be responsible for keeping their records appropriately, too.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Bates, I think there is a strong movement afoot to have patient-controlled data. I think one of the things you see in the Stimulus Act and one of the things that we certainly discussed at length in the HIAC were issues related to privacy and security, and the kind of terminology that's frequently used in these conversations is an opt-in or opt-out system. Opt-out would say the patient's information goes in and the patient would say, no, I want to opt my information out. An opt-in system would be that before the information, the patient's information went into such a system, they would have to have the patient's permission. I think across the country and also reflected in the stimulus bill is the preference for opt-in, which would mean the patient would control whether or not their information went into such a situation. They would decide who would have access, and as Dick mentioned, they would be notified of who was having access, and if a breach occurred, they would be notified of that, and there would be some legal remedies both at the federal level and potentially at the state level according to the Stimulus Act. So I think privacy and security is a huge issue in this area. I will make an observation that I think many patients, myself partially included, have been unaware of how much of their information is moving about today under the provisions of HIPAA and in the course of them receiving treatment and payment for that treatment being rendered. I think some people do not know how quickly that information is being moved about, and what we've seen is when we tell people that, they say, oh no, I can't do that, and then we tell them it's the current situation and current law. Yeah. So I think we have some public education to do, and we also have the opportunity to take advantage of more advanced technology in order to protect privacy and security.
And when is it HIAC? Yeah, starts discussing this, I think that mental health,
yes,
and those that wouldn't sign anything no matter what, as well as in the criminal justice system. So hopefully those conversations are going on also.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And in fact, there is what's called a class of specially protected information, which includes mental health, HIV, STD, sexually transmitted diseases, things like that, which have exceptional protection in Oregon law, and that would be afforded through any of the systems that we would be developing.
Okay. Senator Morris and then Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. How does this bill relate to hospitals? And then the second deals with what, to me, reading the language, where we are creating a council that would, in fact, restrict trade by creating a select provider list for private practices. It screams antitrust. And before we get too far down this road, Madam Chair, I would formally request that our administrator ask Legislative Council for an antitrust violation language in this bill, because I think we're treading on very, very thin ice the way this bill is constructed. And if you think about applying this concept to a variety of products and services that may be provided outside of the medical arena, it would not pass the antitrust test. I'm quite confident of that. So a concern, a question that I'd like to have answered, and then how do we deal with the hospital providers in this context of this council?
I would answer in two ways. First of all, I would beckon back to the stimulus bill and its requirements for meaningful use by hospitals as well. Hospitals who have 10% or more of their patients as Medicaid patients are entitled to reimbursement for the cost of putting health information exchange capability into their facilities. They have at least $2 million available to them from the federal government, and then there's also a sort of Byzantine formula that relates to the number of discharges they have where they get additional money. So for hospitals who have more than 10% of their patients as Medicaid patients, which is most of the hospitals in the state, there would be a minimum of $2 million up to, I think, somewhere in the $7 to $11 million range as enhanced payments from the federal government for adoption of health information exchange capable systems. So this is the ability to start moving data outside of the institutions across to where the patients may be. In addition to that, I think the plan that you would charge the Oversight Council with would be a plan for health information exchange in Oregon. And that is, how will we do that? And what will be the manner in which we will do that? And that sort of begins to set the rules of the game for all the entities. And again, it's how will we bring this together? Will we set up potentially a sort of quasi-utility because this is a public good? What kind of governance structure should we have? The standards have already been called out by the federal government. So then it's a question of, okay, what is the method by which we will do exchange in the state, and that's part of the planning process that you're charging the oversight group with, and that would be that we would presumably use planning grants from the federal government to do too. A variety of other states are ahead of us. Quite frankly, there's probably a half dozen states in the country who are pretty advanced in this area. There's another grouping of states which I would kind of put us into that are in the same kind of stages we're in, which is they need to be doing hopping on their planning, getting their state plans together, and that's done through a collaborative public-private conversation that goes on through entities like this council.
Madam Chair, just as a follow-up, in reading the bill, it's restricted to physicians. Person that identifies persons, not organizations. Would this council be selecting vendors, hardware, software, and technical support for hospitals? And how does that relate if you have one part of your medical providers that are under one regime and the other, the hospitals that are not?
This bill does not provide for the hospitals. I think that we're counting on the interoperability to allow records to be exchanged from vendors of any kind. And this is just going after physicians to try to encourage them to purchase. And there was considerable controversy in our meetings about whether it was appropriate to select just four or five of all the 80-some vendors out there that are offering office electronic medical records for physicians. The feeling was, number one, is if we could pool the buying power of Oregon into a smaller number of vendors, we could get a better price. Number two is we could make sure that it would be faster to interconnect four vendors than 88 vendors, even though in general the standard should cover all 88 over time. And then number three is that it would promote familiarity with certain products so that it would make physicians more likely to buy because they see their colleague buying in a similar sort. So the idea is just trying to decrease the threshold for physicians to get over. The idea is that hospitals would go ahead and invest on health information technology themselves and that it would be interoperable and would be able to exchange information with the physician offices.
I think that in working, when I started working for Clackamas County Public Health, there was no computers, and they started with encounters, the billing and encounters system, and they put out RFPs on their own. We knew nothing what was going on, and it cost us a lot of money because the first software system did not work. So a couple of years of trying to get a system to work, and then the business, they went out of business, and then we were stuck. And so I see that as a help mm-hmm. to those, especially those of us who are not computer savvy, to know which software, which system to adopt. Yeah. Senator Morissette.
Well, just a thought. Kaiser Permanente has a smart card, right? Are you familiar with their smart card?
No. I'm a Kaiser member, and they don't really have a smart card. They have a membership card, and then they have a system where you can access online.
Okay.
So, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a great deal of concern here along the line of what Senator Morris was talking about, and I mentioned earlier the K-12 system and what we have done in that system is rather than force all school districts into a specific number of systems, and there's 197 school districts, what we decided at the state level was we are going to create a data warehouse system where their information could be translated. And I think we will have that system fully operational within the next 2 years. And so it still allows local options, and I'm thinking that there's a lot of community organizations right now that have developed health information systems that are working fine for them, and I don't want to see us being, you know, this, in my view, the state's role in this is to facilitate what's already taking place at the local level. And so I would prefer to see us moving in the direction that the education community is already moving. And it's a good template, and it's working, and it's going to be incredibly successful in a very complicated system, which was, I mean, we're driven by no child in doing that, just because of the amount of data we now have to collect is voluminous. So I'm just not sure that what's proposed here is necessarily moving us in that sort of direction, which I think would be a better way to go.
If I could comment on that real quick. I mean, I think we're currently Oregon has kind of almost 70% EHR adoption already. Whether those are fully meaningful systems under the current rules or not, probably not. But yeah, the committee is aware that we're going to have to support those. I mean, we're not going to change our vendor to a state approved one. We're mature on ours. We're happy with ours. So that is going to have to happen and through those interoperability standards. You know, and I think, you know, if an office, you know, and then going down the road, if one of those remaining 40% chooses one outside of this five, you know, there's nothing that's going to keep them from doing that. I think this committee would still be committed on trying to help them connect. That is the goal of the committee. It would, the level of technical support or the level of financial support may be different because it's not on that list, but we certainly wouldn't be restricting that in any way. And I think just because of the diverse systems that already exist, and then speaking to the comment about hospitals, they're on very different systems. So it's not going to be a unified vendor between hospitals and clinics. Those are very different scales, very different needs, very different uses. So, again, the focus on these interoperable standards and creating that infrastructure is going to be a main charge of this group.
Madam Chair, I just think that speaks to it. I mean, we're focused on individuals here. There's more in the system, and if we're wanting a system-wide enterprise here, and I truly think we are, that's why I think that the data warehouse concept fits in with a more universal approach to this thing. And just my opinion, and I'm just a simple country boy. I don't, you know.
Right, and there's a whole growing industry of companies where their only job is that translation of data. So whether they're not necessarily warehousing that, but they are providing the software to make that translation.
Right.
Those exist now. So that is a strategy that exists.
Yes.
The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act also is providing, we're told, $18 billion for U.S. physicians to get compensation for investing in meaningful use of an electronic health record. So in other words, even though this bill doesn't buy electronic records for Oregon physicians, presumably the ARRA will do that. And all the systems that will be purchased need to be certified by the CCHIT to be interoperable. So that, I think going forward, I think it's very reasonable to say American is a free enterprise system. There are many vendors competing, and if the senators decide not to have the selection of four, I don't think that that's a crucial aspect of the bill, in that the stimulus for physicians to purchase an EMR and the interoperability standards will still be there, and we still will serve the Oregon citizens.
So, Ree, will you take to heart what the committee said, and before we submit, maybe we, Mr. Shook can already submit these amendments, but we need to get that concern from Legislative Council, and then look at, and then develop maybe a second set of amendments regarding the antitrust issue and the that piece.
Yes, Madam Chair, we will look into the question of antitrust relative to this, and we have shared the amendments with your committee administrator, and I believe LC is working on them at this point in time. So I will follow up to see what, if anything, we need to do to avoid an antitrust situation and also still be able to afford some kind of assistance to physicians in terms of getting them into the world of interoperability.
Well, this is the wave of the future. It is. I know that IS here in this building is so trying to have us go paperless. Where's the chart? We're on the floor and we don't have a chart to deal with.
Yeah.
So for those of us who are a little older, you know, and not grown up with computer systems, it'll be harder for us to adjust, but we will adjust.
Okay.
All right, we have one more to testify, and that's Andrea Meyer, if there are no other questions for this panel. Okay.
When did that clock quit working?
Yes, this clock is not working. So
it's moving back and forth there a little bit.
High tech.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. As you gathered, these are very difficult and challenging issues. And privacy and consumer protections are fundamental to all of this. While ACLU was not a formal part of HIAC, I attended all the hearings and became a formal member of the Privacy and Security Work Group. And so we have had some involvement in this legislation. And I am pleased, particularly in Section 5, to see much of that reflected in terms of being aware of the critical issues around consumer and patient protections. I want to add a few quick notes. I do need to raise some concerns about reducing the membership level from 23 to 11. There was not space for the ACLU at this rather large group, and I think there are a lot of important voices that came to that group, a lot of folks from different disciplines that need to be there, but also consumer and privacy and technology experts, be they the techies, as well as just the privacy advocates, and reducing it to 11 raises concerns that it may not allow a true reflection of the need of all the folks who should be at the table. So I would raise some caution about that and push back a little bit on whether it needs to be reduced and or whether it needs to be reduced by that substantive large amount. One of the things that came out in the privacy and security subgroup was actually comments from other people how important it is that there be a remedy and there be the best systems built, because consumer reliance, consumer trust in this system is critical. And once it's lost, it's going to be very hard to get back. And so by ensuring that there are some strict remedies available if there's a breach. It helps encourage those who are participating to build the best systems and participate in the best systems at the front end so that they are never subject to any penalties. So if I may quickly, and then I will conclude, on Section 5, I want to just note a few things on page 3, lines 5 through 7. You've got the critical language about privacy and security controls and that data cannot be used for purposes other than patient care or otherwise allowed by law. There's been some discussion about the opting in, and also there is language also in the bill about patients being able to consent or choose to participate in that program on line 19. That's very important. I would just simply raise that other things that were discussed in the work group were no penalty if someone chooses not to participate in it, that they not be subject to any penalty for failing or being unwilling to choose to participate. Notice that data will be shared. I think there's some language in here about requesting that, and if there isn't, just be aware of requesting data in certain situations not to be shared. You've talked about mental health and other protected data, and there may be situations where folks choose not to have all of their information shared but want some of it. Patient access to the record. I know there's whole discussions. I'm not getting into this in terms of ownership and who builds these systems, but having patient access to their own records is critical. In lines 20, it talks about providing meaningful remedies if security and privacy policies are violated. That's important, but also needs to be requirements that if there is a breach, they know about it. So you can't have meaningful remedies if you don't know what that something has happened. So I just raised those. We will continue, ACLU will continue to, as we can, be involved. I think it's important. I raised some concern during the process of the HIAC that privacy, I was pleased that there was a privacy and security work group. I mean, that's where, after they did a lot of visioning, a lot of prioritizing, that there was a recognition of that need. However, I will continue to say that when we look at these systems, when we look at any part of this program, that privacy and security should be woven into it and not necessarily siloed into a separate piece. So when you talk about all these other things that you've been talking about, please think about and what privacy aspects and what consumer rights are there and at issue on this particular area that you discuss. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any, but I appreciate the time to briefly testify and raise ACLU's perspective.
All right. Thank you, Andrea, very much. No further questions. I'm going to close then the public hearing on Senate Bill 452 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 454. Mr. Shook?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 454 has a lot of stuff in it. It has two major themes. First of all, it establishes a data reporting requirements for insurers to include changes in administrative expenses in rate filings, requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to approve the increase in administrative expenses, and authorizes the director to establish by rule uniform statewide standards for administrative functions of licensed health insurers. It also authorizes the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research to collect and report changes in contracted prices for services provided by a health benefit plan, adopt reporting requirements for capital projects proposed by hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers, and to adopt rules to ensure full disclosure about expected impact of those capital projects on the community intended to be served.
All right, I only have people against this bill that have signed up. So who from the Oregon Health Fund Board is going to talk about this? Oh, Carol. All right. Carol Robinson. And Teresa Miller.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Monis Anderson and committee members, I'm Carol Robinson, Interim Director for the Oregon Health Fund Board. I'd like to offer the microphone first to Teresa Miller to talk about the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm currently the acting administrator for the insurance division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I was actually going to testify about a small piece of the bill, but a piece that's a pretty large piece for the division, and that's the administrative expenses provision of the bill. Under the current division's rate filing process, insurers report administrative costs as a percent of total premium. So the department approves a single rate change that arguably allows an insurer's administrative expenses to grow at the same rate as medical costs. But I think, as the Oregon Health Fund Board pointed out in their final report, the cost drivers associated with insurer's administrative expenses should be more aligned with the general rate of inflation than they should be with medical inflation. So at the division, we do believe it makes sense for administrative expenses to be separately reviewed, separate from the rest of the rate filing, and for a different standard to be applied for increases to these expenses. Senate Bill 454 provides that increases in administrative expenses that exceed the general rate of inflation will be denied absent sufficient justification by the insurer that such increases are necessary and appropriate. And we think that this will not only provide for additional transparency around the various components of an insurer's administrative expenses, but it will also provide for appropriate additional scrutiny of increases in these expenses. And just so the committee knows, this provision of Senate Bill 454 is also contained in at least a couple of other bills. I know there's a companion House bill, House Bill 2130, I believe. But we also have, as a division, House Bill 2433, which also contains this provision. So with that, Madam Chair, that was the section of the bill that I wanted to address. Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Teresa, you don't have the ability now to look at the various components in the rate case and make a determination on them?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz,
whatever.
I almost gave you a promotion. That's actually a good question. I think we do have the ability to take a look at these now. Given the conversations around the Health Fund Board and around this topic in the Health Fund Board, we felt that it was appropriate to have the legislature weigh in on this issue, but this is something that we believe we could do even without legislative direction. But again, given the fact that this was part of a larger conversation around many of these issues that the Oregon Health Fund Board had, we felt that it was appropriate that you guys at least have the opportunity to weigh in.
Okay, Madam Chair, this is, you know, a rate increase has many components in it, and DCBS mm-hmm. has the ability to weigh in on all those components before they grant approval. So I'm not sure this necessarily changes anything. This component necessarily changes status quo. So
you
it may
comment?
Change it, but not necessarily in a positive way.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, this is not the standard that we use now. As I mentioned, now insurers report administrative expenses as a percent of their total premium. So we don't use the standard that's currently in this bill today. So this would change our process, just to be clear.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, I'd like to also introduce Laura Atherton from Osberg to testify in favor of this bill, and then I will give you a summary of the bill after Laura testifies.
Okay. Hi, my name is Laura Atherton, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm the advocate with Osberg. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in strong support of this bill. Osberg, I was fortunate enough to serve on a number of the committees that reported to the Health Fund Board, and want to express our just real respect for that process and the recommendations that have come forward. Just to step back for a moment and look at the problem that this bill is really addressing, gets to the rising cost of healthcare, something that consumers and businesses around this state are getting hammered by rising premiums and rising out-of-pocket costs. The current economic situation is really just throwing the need for reform into even sharper contrast as small businesses decide whether or not to continue, whether or not to even begin, given the high cost of health care, and as families are facing very difficult decisions with the economic downturn. In terms of, I think this bill provides some very good recommendations on some key pieces, some very concrete pieces on how to cut costs, not by cutting care, but by cutting waste in the system. And a couple pieces of the bill that I wanted to highlight for you. First, it limits the growth, as Ms. Miller has testified, limits the growth in health insurance, the growth in health insurance administrative costs. And I do want to note this would actually, if enforced, represent a change from business as usual, from what's currently happening, where, after reviewing, for example, the rates that have been approved over the last year, health insurance administrative costs have been going up, right in line with medical inflation, and in times more than that. So even at the rate of more like 20% increase right in that administrative portion of the cost. And that really, right now, there's not a process where the insurer justifies that. Now, maybe those increases in costs are justified. Perhaps they are necessary. They're reducing future costs. They're helping to put some information technology that can save costs in the future. They're improving care. But right now, that isn't justified. And this bill specifically directs the insurance division not to approve increases in administrative costs unless they are justified, and that is a change. That while the division has the ability to look at that right now, this bill makes it very clear that protecting consumers from excessive administrative costs on insurance is important and a job that needs to be done. Secondly, I wanted to highlight another key piece of the bill, which is cutting some of that insurance red tape. If you've heard from the committee testifying on the previous bill on health information technology, there's tremendous efficiency that can be made in the health system. This bill looks at developing, instead of the myriad forms for billings and claims and credentialing, the myriad forms that take up insurers and take up providers' time, let's develop one form, electronic, that can replace those forms and allow providers to spend time actually taking care of patients and making Oregon one of the healthiest places to live as opposed to a place where paperwork and red tape is what's really consuming providers' time. Finally, the pieces in the bill that boost transparency and accountability. Healthcare spending is an incredibly huge part of our economy, nationally and in the state. And it's astounding how much we don't know how much what our healthcare dollars are buying. Moving toward transparency is absolutely critical to make sure Oregonians' healthcare dollars are going to the very best possible care and to identify further areas of waste and identify what's working. This bill includes both getting important information about the level of insurance coverage across the state, so we know what we're dealing with there, and also looks at what we're getting for our money in terms of what are the contracted rates between hospitals and insurers, so researchers and health officials can look at that information, and to bring in community input into capital projects that hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers are moving forward with in communities, and taking a look at what are the impacts of that of those capital projects, both on improving health or increasing the cost of health care, so that real discussion can happen at the community level as well. Again, OSPIRC supports this bill in addition to the whole package of bills that implement the recommendations of the Health Fund Board. All together, those recommendations have the potential to save Oregonians $10 billion in health care costs over 10 years. And this bill alone, I think, exceeds $4 billion in 10 years in savings. So it has the potential to save people money and move us in the right direction on transparency and standing up for consumers against rising costs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. No questions?
I'd like to know where the $10 billion came from. Show me the figures.
Senator Monis Anderson, or Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz, there is a policy brief that has been put together by the Oregon Office of Health Policy and Research on the cost containment estimates of the seven bills that you will be hearing, that you have been hearing, and you will continue to hear next week from the Health Fund Board, and I'll make sure that that is included in your packet of information for next week's hearing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Stay in the room because we may have questions for you afterwards. Carol, you want to sum up? All right.
Ignore Carol. That would be a
thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and committee. Building block number two of the board's plan, Aim High, Building a Healthy Oregon, calls for setting high standards for Oregon's health care, measuring and reporting. Gathering trusted information, setting high standards, and then measuring and reporting on those standards are essential to driving quality improvement, cost containment, and ultimately more informed decision-making by consumers, providers, purchasers, insurers, and policymakers. And then adding to that, building block three takes that information that has been gathered and measured and applies it to price evaluation, bringing a rational approach to insurance administrative rate increases. Senate Bill 454 is an important piece of legislation in several ways, and I'd like to outline those for you in more detail. But first, I'd like to bring your attention to the fact that there's a couple of amendments that have been put forward and are not included in the current bill's form. And I'd also like to note that the on your fact sheet that has been given to you, there's fiscal impact on the backside. There have even at after close of business yesterday, we were still getting recalculations on those numbers. The total fund fiscal impact on this bill should be $142,860, with the general fund being $87,335 and the matching federal funds being $55,525. So we will make those corrections on your fact sheet and get those to the committee as well. Senate Bill 454 will improve Oregon's ability to ascertain variation in healthcare pricing and insurance coverage at the community level and at the regional level. I'm sure you can think of several reasons why this would be important information to the state. First of all, cost trends in different healthcare markets can be compared. Why might it cost significantly more to have a certain procedure in one part of the state than in another? So drilling down to that line of sight between provider price increases in a local market and the resulting changes in health insurance premiums will not only drive better contracting, but it can also provide a window to evaluate healthcare facility and technology investments in a given community. And then extending that line of sight to track the link between premium cost changes and the loss of commercial insurance coverage within localities would further the ability of policymakers to spot the canary in a coal mine or identify those communities having success in encouraging a vibrant competitive market. In addition to tracking data by business lines and zip codes, which Senate Bill 454 does, it also requires insurers and third-party administrators to report their administrative rate increases to the insurance division on a per-member, per-month basis. The graph at the end of this testimony shows the escalating difference between the Consumer Price Index and the Medical Consumer Price Index, as Teresa Miller previously testified. The expectation of the Health Fund Board is that the administrative costs of health insurance should be tracking closely with the CPI, but unfortunately they have been rising on average at a rate closer to medical CPI. And just looking at that graph for a minute, you can really see why cost containment has come up front on the Health Fund Board's recommendations. While the bill allows for some flexibility in the review of administrative rates, such as when a large-scale investment in health information technology might be undertaken, there would indeed be scrutiny of rate increases in administrative costs where justification of an increase above that CPI rate would be evaluated. The third area where Senate Bill 454 brings more transparency and accountability to healthcare is in Section 8 of the bill. Community input for expansion of healthcare facilities and the purchase of expensive medical equipment does not always occur in Oregon. SB 454 would require hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers to post notice of a proposed capital project in a major newspaper serving the region of the project. And it would also require them to host a public meeting to explain the proposal and solicit feedback from interested stakeholders. Community input early in this deliberative process would help healthcare facilities proposing a new project to better understand the needs of their community and at times to modify a project according to those needs. For example, many people have recently felt frustrated that the development of two tertiary pediatric hospitals in Portland was an ineffective use of healthcare resources. Without requirements in place, there was no public process available to voice those concerns. Another example where the requirement for a community input process could have been useful was in the recent development process of a new hospital in the Eugene area. Many of the contentious issues surrounding that certificate of need process for a new hospital were related to transportation and urban planning. So that earlier community feedback process could have provided the local government the tools to make better decisions, as well as the state to consider those aspects within their certificate of need deliberations. So localities right now are currently entitled to weigh in on major expenditures by schools, libraries, road improvements, and other local services that impact quality of life and community costs. And we, the Health Fund Board, feels that large expenditures by health facilities should be no different. The final piece of the bill that could produce substantial cost savings for Oregon, as Laura Epperton mentioned, is the standardization of administrative functions across insurers doing business in the state in Oregon. Imagine the potential for a single claim form across all insurers to improve productivity, reduce errors, and lower costs. Senate Bill 454 would allow Oregon to change a paradigm where consumers have little voice in the healthcare investments in their community and little ability to understand the driving factors in healthcare costs. In order to make these improvements, transparency must come first, and then system improvement will be driven by the information that that transparency provides. We know we can make a substantial difference in reducing cost variations between communities with this bill, improve community decision-making at the place where the rubber hits the road, and simply save money by getting a handle on administrative costs and creating the standard forms. The Oregon Health Fund Board encourages you to support the passage of SB 454. I'd be happy to answer questions.
I think we may have questions after we hear the opposition. But we have one more in favor, and that is Al Bradbury.
Should I begin?
Mm-hmm.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Alexandra Bradbury. I work as a researcher on healthcare policy for Service Employees International Union, Local 49. SEIU Local 49 represents 6,000 janitors and healthcare workers in Oregon, and we're actively engaged in healthcare reform both here in Oregon and at the national level, and we're active participants in the efforts of the Oregon Health Fund Board. I appear on behalf of the union to support Senate Bill 454. In particular, I want to call your attention to Section 8, which addresses a critical need in Oregon's healthcare system. We applaud this timely step to introduce a public voice into the planning of healthcare facilities. Our union has long supported strengthening the community voice in healthcare planning on the state, regional, and local levels. And with our partners in the Make Healthcare Work campaign, we've advocated for community involvement in proactively assessing healthcare needs, as well as for a stronger regulatory framework for healthcare facilities expansions. As you're aware, hospital expansion is often designed to increase a hospital's bottom line rather than to serve community needs. And certain services, such as diagnostic imaging, outpatient surgery, cancer care, and heart surgery, are profit centers. Hospitals need to provide these relatively well-compensated services in order to make enough money to offer charity care and to assure a proper level of staffing for the less profitable services. However, in the absence of a steadying public hand, both hospital and non-hospital providers engage in a continual race to corner the market on these most profitable services. Record sums are spent to build new hospital beds and centers for the most profitable lines of service, even when these new facilities simply duplicate the existing capacity of nearby providers, while critical shortages are increasingly apparent in primary care and mental health services. Redundant expansion not only drives up the cost of care for everyone, but also takes resources away from areas of real need and has a destabilizing impact on existing providers. By introducing public input into the planning of healthcare facilities, we can help contain costs and provide for the healthcare services that our communities need. On two specific points, on the scope and the timing, we urge you to make recommendations to the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research as it implements Section 8 of the Act to ensure that the law is meaningfully effective. As to the scope, the bill directs UPR to set the cost threshold that would determine which capital projects were subject to this process. It would be wise for UPR to err on the side of setting a low threshold, inclusive of many projects. One of the weaknesses of Oregon's current Certificate of Need law, which is one of the weakest in the nation, is that it applies to almost nothing short of an entire new hospital. It would be a shame for this new law to replicate this problem. After all, a project's financial impact on the community is not limited to the direct capital cost of the building, but also includes the ongoing cost of offering the health services, the cost of the project's potential impact on other providers in the delivery system, and the opportunity cost of expanding this service instead of other services the community may need. The other point is on timing. It's very important that the rules that UPR adopts should provide for the public disclosure and community input to happen early enough in the process for the conversation to have a real impact on the proposed project and not after so many costs are already sunk that it would be hard to reverse or change the project. I also want to just briefly express the union's support for Section 5, which will appropriately hold insurers accountable to work to keep administrative processes efficient, and for Section 6, which would provide for UPR to gather and analyze data on the contracted prices paid by insurers and third-party administrators for health services, codifying and expanding the data program that UPR and the insurance division of DCBS have recently initiated. We applaud this as a significant contribution to the public policy conversation about healthcare cost and value. However, we respectfully submit that it's not appropriate for this law to judge the price data to be proprietary and trade secret information, as the bill currently does in subsection 4. Trade secrets are already exempted from public disclosure under ORS 192.501, Section 2, which gives a careful and specific definition. Were the prices between hospitals and insurers really trade secrets, they would be covered under the existing law. We believe that although providers and insurers have treated them with secrecy, the prices of healthcare services are not trade secrets and are quite different from the kinds of information described in ORS 192.501. We further believe that these data are of great interest to consumers. So right now, UPR makes available its hospital discharge data set for policy research with appropriate safeguards to protect patient anonymity, and this data has facilitated much research work of public value. We believe the law should allow UPR to offer the health services price data to the public in a similar manner, so we respectfully request the committee amend the bill to eliminate subsection 4 under section 6. Thank you very much.
Were all those recommendations in your testimony?
Yes.
Would you make sure that Carol and Dr. Smith and Teresa have them and make comments and work with them on possible, some kind of collaboration on your issues?
I'd be happy to.
Issues.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Dave Fiskum, Lisa Vance, and is it Carrie Walker?
Yeah. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Dave Fiske, I'm here representing Providence Health System, which, as you know, may remember, we operate 7 hospitals in urban and rural Oregon, in Milwaukee, Newburgh, Hood River, Seaside, Medford, Portland. We run a major health insurance plan. We also offer special programs for medically fragile children as well as older adults in Providence Elder Place in several Portland locations and Providence Benedictine in Mount Angel. So, Madam Chair, it is from this statewide perspective that we ask this morning that you not move forward with Senate Bill 454, which we believe does not advance the cause of health care reform in this state, a cause which we know you support and which we hope you know we support. What Senate Bill 454 will do is add to administrative costs and burdens at a time when we should really be engaged full-time in finding ways to reduce the cost of health care collaboratively and to bring health care services within reach of more Oregonians. To make these points, I'm joined this morning by 2 officials from Providence Health System. To my immediate right is Lisa Vance, the CEO of Providence Portland Medical Center, the facility you can see as you drive on I-84 near the Hollywood District in Portland. And I know you, Madam Chair, have spent some time at Providence Portland and know Ms. Vance from the tour of her facility she provided for you last year. And then to Ms. Vance's right is Carrie Walker, the Director of Underwriting for Providence Health Plans. Together, they will attempt to deal with most, if not all, of the sections of the Senate Bill 454, which, and I know you know this, they deal with both health system, hospital, as well as health insurance issues. So, Madam Chair, with your indulgence, I'll turn first to Ms. Vance and then Mr. Walker, and I would just add a quick footnote that Karen Weiland, Chief Design and Construction Officer for Providence Health System, is just behind us in the room and will be available to help answer questions, especially on Section 8, if you have such questions after our testimony. Lisa.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Lisa Vance. I work for Providence Health and Services, where I am the Chief Executive at Providence Portland Medical Center. I'm here today on behalf of Providence to oppose Section 8 of Senate Bill 454. I felt it was important to be here in person to give you some detail about our health system's concerns.
Now, you're just addressing Section 8.
I am, just my section, yes. Okay. We have submitted for the record my letter of testimony on this bill, so you should have that.
Mm-hmm.
Since our earliest beginnings, Providence has been committed to responsible growth and thoughtful health care planning. We do all this for our patients to provide them with convenient, quality health care. Providence conducts extensive analysis and planning before embarking on a decision to build, renew, or expand any facility. Now, how does the current process work? When we decide that community health care needs would be best met by renovating or constructing a new building, we must then build in anywhere from 6 months to 2 years for that planning and to work with local government to get their approval. We respect and work with this extensive land use and local government process that already exists to review these construction projects. Time and again, we've observed local jurisdictions conducting a full review of our planned projects. We welcome this process, which usually includes hearings and opportunities for public comment, questions, and refinements of these projects. Our hospitals, including Providence Portland, reach out to neighborhood associations and community planning organizations. We want to inform them about projects in their areas and hear from them in return, and we do this quite early on in our thinking. For building a new hospital, there's already a very good review process in place called Certificate of Need Requirement. CON also includes public hearings and provides ample opportunity for public to comment on plans, ask questions, and request changes. So in summary, Section 8 of this bill would add unnecessary complexity and cost to projects. A comprehensive and complex process already exists, governed well by local jurisdictions. We strongly question the value of a new oversight for public good, given that this review already exists. We ask you to set aside these provisions and allow local jurisdictions to continue representing the public interest on construction projects in their communities. Thanks for the opportunity to comment today. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kerry Walker, and I work with Providence Health Plans as the Director of Underwriting. I'm here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services to comment on the various insurance provisions of Senate Bill 454. Specifically, I'll be speaking to Sections 3, 4, 5, 6, and 9. Starting with Section 3, this requires annual reporting of specific data. I would note that Providence Health Plans is currently readily available to provide this information. However, this would be an additional reporting requirement beyond the information that's provided on a quarterly basis currently. We would hope that there is sufficient value in providing this additional information to warrant the added administrative expense borne by carriers. Each new reporting requirement, of course, does add to the administrative cost of health insurers and ultimately the insured population. Turning to Section 4, we do have many questions about this section and ask that it be deleted in its entirety. We are concerned that having the state involved in the creation and management of the administrative business model for health insurers is intrusive and inefficient. This provision, we are concerned, will interfere with insurers' abilities to compete efficiently in the market, and further that it will limit new business models and stifle industry innovation. Moreover, we are unclear as to what financial savings would in effect be realized as a result of this section. Section 5 speaks to the state review of administrative expenses. Over the past 20 years that I've worked with the Division of Insurance in submitting and discussing rate filings, I would note that the Division of Insurance presently receives information regarding the administrative expenses and that portion of the rate filing that such expenses comprise. We believe that prudently incurred administrative expenses are already subject to close and vigorous review by the Division of Insurance as part of the normal rate submission and review process. As I noted earlier, adding yet additional data reporting and review requirements to those substantial reporting requirements already in place will further serve to increase the cost of submitting filings as well as the end cost to insurers. Also in Section 5, we do have specific concerns about the definition of reasonable increases in administrative expenses. There appears to be no objective criteria within the bill presently to determine what is in fact a reasonable increase. Moving to Section 6, we note that this requires the reporting of proprietary information and trade secret information. We believe this is outside of the DCPS's current regulatory powers and is too expansive a provision. Lastly, in speaking to Section 9, this section would appear to introduce the ability or authority to disapprove or withdraw the approval of previously approved rate filings. The concern to us is that this would pose a significant dilemma in our long-term business planning and expense controls. We believe that the Division of Insurance presently has the authority and capability to make a thorough and in-depth review of a rate filing and to carry that rate filing out in a timely basis. We are concerned that upon receiving approval, that approval might be subsequently withdrawn at any point in time in the future. In conclusion, we suggest that the provisions of this bill be reviewed in light of similar requirements contained in House Bills 2432 and 2433 that are currently offered by the state. It seems to us that multiple bills are addressing similar issues, and it would be better to consolidate these issues as much as possible within a single bill. Thank you.
That's Senate Bill 242 and 243?
Actually, House Bill 2432 and...
Oh, 2432. Oh, yeah.
House Bill 2433, Madam Chair.
Campaign.
Madam Chair, 2432 and 2433, both House bills.
Yes.
Thank you.
No questions at this point. We're running out of time, and I know I'm taking a look at who's left on the list, and I want to take those that aren't in the building a lot. And it looks like Jeff Knapp and Chip Lazur. We will be carrying this bill over till Thursday.
Yeah. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jeff Knapp. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Lane Powell at 601 Southwest 2nd Avenue in Portland, Oregon. I've been practicing law in Oregon for 20 years, and 15 of those years I have been an employee benefits attorney. I'm here today at the request of a firm client, A&I Benefit Plan Administrators, and I've been asked to address some of the legal difficulties with Senate Bill 454 as it applies to third-party administrators. I'll be primarily interested in Sections 3 and 6 of the bill. Section 2 is a definitional section, and so it's also implicated, but the substantive provisions are in Section 3 and 6. Just so we all understand what a third-party administrator does, it's administration refers to administration of an employee benefit plan, and in the context of this bill, it would be a group health plan. Well, a health plan is a little bit like a corporation. It has a legal existence, but it can only act through agents and employees. Unlike a corporation, a health plan generally doesn't have employees, and so it uses agents. And in the context of operating the plan, it typically contracts with a third-party administrator. Third-party administrators will do things such as track eligibility, receive and record employee and employer contributions, make payments to plan service providers, prepare financial statements, send information about the plan to plan participants, and process claims for benefits. When you attempt to regulate any of these areas, even though you may nominally be regulating the third-party administrator, in effect you are regulating the health plan because it can only act through the third-party administrator. This creates an issue of conflict between federal and state law. Health plans are regulated by a federal law called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. This law contains an extremely broad preemption clause, which essentially states that state laws that relate to employee benefit plans are preempted by federal law. The reason for doing this was because the Congress wanted to avoid subjecting employee benefit plans to conflicting dictates among the states or between the states and the federal government. Now, ERISA contains very strict and comprehensive fiduciary duties for the people who are responsible for operating the plan, and very strict and detailed regulations for reporting of information to plan participants. Senate Bill 454 would violate these preemption principles by imposing administrative burdens in the form of reporting requirements on third-party administrators and, in effect, on employee benefit plans. We heard in testimony today that one of the goals of Senate Bill 454 is to increase transparency to participants. The problem with that is that ERISA already contains transparency provisions, disclosure and reporting requirements to participants that are very detailed, and if the state attempts to impose additional or different requirements than those that are required by ERISA, then it will run into a problem with ERISA preemption. Similarly, in terms of transparency of costs or reporting costs, employee benefit plans are already required to report those costs on Schedule C to Form 5500, which is an annual return that's filed by the plan, which provides detailed information about the payments that the plan has made. The state cannot add, change, or subtract those reporting requirements. The Department of Labor has also issued proposed regulations regarding the content of contracts between employee benefit plans and employee benefit plan service providers that also contain detailed disclosure requirements. In addition, I'd like to point out that Senate Bill 454 as drafted is confusing and creates an unfair two-tier reporting structure because it applies to third-party administrators that are licensed under ORS 744.702. Currently, third-party administrators that only administer ERISA employee benefit plans are exempt from licensure under this statutory provision. And this is as it should be because of ERISA preemption. However, there are third-party administrators that administer both ERISA plans and non-ERISA plans, and those third-party administrators are licensed. As the bill is currently drafted, those third-party administrators would be subject to all of the reporting requirements under the bill, while other third-party administrators providing exactly the same services would be exempt. For these reasons, I believe that Senate Bill 454 has significant legal challenges, and I would oppose the bill on behalf of my client, ANI Benefit Plan Administrators. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. I think it's still morning, isn't it? My name is Chip Legere. Madam Chair, I'm glad to be here. I'm the Vice President of J.E. Dunn Construction, based in Portland, Oregon. We're a large commercial and industrial construction firm with offices in Portland and Seattle. We do about $300 million a year here in the Northwest, and we're part of a larger corporation, J.E. Dunn Construction Group, which does about $3 billion a year nationally. Out of that, about one-third of our entire business is building healthcare-related projects. And we strongly object to Section 8 of the Senate Bill 454 for two main reasons. One, it will cause delays in capital construction by healthcare providers, resulting in fewer jobs and increased construction costs, which we really can ill afford in this economy. Two, we do not see that it will add value to the process. There already exists well-defined certificate of need processes and other land use proceedings to consider healthcare projects on a public basis. Anytime we do a project, we always go through design review and public hearings where early on in the design process, neighborhoods and the community provide input into that design, and it does get changed, and those ideas do get incorporated as appropriate. And I'd reiterate what Lisa Vance testified to. This there's really already processes in place, and we have public hearings that allow for input. I've described these reasons and more in the attached letter in my testimony, which I'm leaving behind for the committee. I do appreciate your time today, and if you have any questions for me, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. No, there are no questions at this point because we're needing to be on the floor shortly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will carry this over. I do want to read into the record, though. We have a letter from John Jurgens and Associates, and basically they say this bill would add additional layers of bureaucracy and would delay final approvals while adding considerable cost to projects. Also, the bill would add more regulation, paperwork, red tape, and would inevitably burden healthcare institutions in Oregon. Another letter from Daniel Jim, Vice President and Operations Manager of Turner Construction Company, basically with the same concerns, as well as Robert Packard from Zimmer
Gunsel-Frasca
Architects, who also have the same concerns. Thank you very much, and we will need to have further discussion, and we will continue this on Thursday. With that, we're adjourned. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 454, and we are adjourned. Thank you.